The American Revolutionary War of 1776 has been heralded as a leap forward for humankind that codified enlightened principles of freedom and liberty and overcame the tyranny of a British king. It's a story we've been taught since we were kids, and while we know about the paradox of white men seeking freedom while they themselves held slaves, rarely do we hear about slavery's role in the revolution. Well, my guest, Professor Gerald Horn, who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morse Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, is arguing, despite all that we've been told, that the Revolutionary War was a conservative counter-revolution against the growing prospects of the abolition of slavery. He writes about it in a new book called The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States. Professor Gerald Horn, it is my great pleasure to welcome you back to our studio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And congratulations on your book. Your publisher has told us that they're out of copies right now and they're having to make more. So you're getting quite a bit of attention on your book.
Well, I think people are looking for a new story of the origins of this country, a story that connects the past with the present, a story that sheds light on this question. If 1776 and the formation of the United States of America was such a great leap forward for humanity, then why did the plight and conditions for those at the bottom of the socioeconomic pyramid plummet after the so-called revolutionary's triumph? I'm speaking, of course, in the first place of the indigenous population, whose land was taken even more after 1776, and, of course, the African population, whose plight and condition worsened after the triumph of the so-called revolution. And how was it that after the formation of the United States, U.S. slave dealers replaced the British as the captains of the international slave trade? You may be familiar with my previous book, The Deepest South, the United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade, where I talk about how one of the many reasons you have so many African people in Brazil is because of the manic energy of U.S. slave dealers. I have a book coming out in a few weeks called Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. And that same truism holds true for Cuba. That is to say, one of the reasons you have so many people of African descent in Cuba is because of U.S. slave dealers. So in many ways, the traditional narrative of 1776 really doesn't make any sense because it doesn't explain or shed light upon subsequent developments, including how it was that the United States became leader of the international right wing by 2014.
You call the narrative of 1776 our creation myth.
Oh, yeah.
Our creation story.
Well, look, I mean, as you suggested in your introductory remarks, you have these leading slave owners, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, John Hancock, whose name appears on the founding document, the so-called Declaration of Independence, was one of the largest slave owners in Massachusetts. John Adams, who serves as second president after George Washington, was a leading lawyer for slave owners in Massachusetts. As is well known, before the U.S. Civil War, a disproportionate percentage of the U.S. presidents not only hailed from Virginia, but were Virginia slave owners. And it's
And that was sort of a legacy of our college, electoral college.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And the whole three-fifths compromise, whereby people of African descent were to be counted as three-fifths of a human being for purposes of, for example, congressional representation, which put the thumb of Dixie on the scales when it came to elections and election results. So once again, the traditional story, the traditional narrative of the foundation of the United States really doesn't make any sense, and it's more than fair to call it a creation myth.
What about this idea that we oftentimes hear about, especially on the left, about this paradox that the revolution incorporated enlightened ideas of liberty, democracy, taxation without representation? And of course, these were limited because these were not afforded to Africans, not afforded to women. Nonetheless, it was a step forward that we are striving for a more quote unquote perfect union, and that our struggle is to ensure that eventually everybody gets these, again, quote unquote, inalienable rights.
Well, that's a very important point to raise. And I dare say that when people look at apartheid South Africa, the conclusion is not drawn that because Pretoria was able to create a kind of social democracy for those of European descent, that that did not validate apartheid. If you look at the Dominican Republic in the 1930s, the dictator Rafael Trujillo went overboard in terms of trying to rescue those fleeing persecution in Europe. But that was in part for reasons that held true in North America. That is to say, he wanted to, quote, whiten, unquote, his population. And at the same time, he was massacring Haitians along the border. You have to keep in mind that in the late 18th century, when the United States was being formed, the rebels who founded the United States had a severe demographic problem. That is to say, in many precincts, particularly in Dixie, the indigenous and the Africans outnumbered the Europeans. So how could you attract Europeans, even poor Europeans, to a war zone where they ran the risk of being massacred, liquidated by rebellious and uproarious indigenous and Africans? Well, you have to offer them certain benefits. You have to offer them certain emoluments. You have to offer them certain liberties that they did not necessarily enjoy in Western Europe. And at the same time, of course, you could dangle the carrot of getting land from the Native Americans stocked by enslaved Africans. That's one of the many reasons why it's been so difficult to extend those liberties to those of us not defined as white, because the United States in many ways was the first apartheid state, as I note in the text. And I think that the closer we come to the truth of the story, the more we can understand why today's climb is so steep, that is to say, to expand opportunities for the rest of us.
I mean, we're talking more than 200 years to try to get these opportunities, and you draw a line from slavery to Jim Crow to today. It's inequality.
Well, the sad fate and destiny, particularly of people of African descent, is that one of the reasons we have been treated so atrociously is that we were in the forefront of fighting against a slaveholder's republic, which saw us as primary victims. And then we were in the forefront of fighting against a Jim Crow regime, which saw us as primary victims. And today, some of the stories that you hear, as for example, the recent Department of Education story that suggested that black preschoolers are suspended at a spectacularly high rate compared to other non-black preschoolers. The disproportionate representation on death row, for example, including that rather ghoulish execution that was attempted in Oklahoma just a few days ago. The fact that we're disproportionately represented in prisons. All of this, even as President Obama suggested, is a legacy of slavery, a legacy of Jim Crow, a legacy of continuing inequality. But I would go a step further, and I do go a step further in this text, to suggest that racism is a necessary, though insufficient, explanatory factor in understanding the plight of people of African descent in particular. That is to say that racism hardly explains why it is that the activist Angela Davis talks about growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, and when she wanted to escape the strictures of Jim Crow in department stores, she would go in the department store and speak French and she would be treated better. That's a familiar story from black life. The same story is told, except it's speaking Spanish, by James Weldon Johnson, a former NAACP leader, by Raymond Pace Alexander, a former lawyer in Philadelphia. It's even replicated in popular culture in the Richard Pryor vehicle, Bingo Long's Traveling All-Stars, about the Negro baseball leagues and how when they go on the field, they speak a kind of gibberish, which they were hoping people would see as Spanish or some other language, so they wouldn't be perceived as public enemy number one, i.e. the descendants of enslaved mainland Africans. That is to say, when you fight a war, as many Africans did against 1776, and lose, not only are you punished, but your descendants continue to be punished forevermore. That's not peculiar or unique to North America. That's something that happens in many different countries. I would go further to say that even after 1776, as represented in my previous book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans in the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation, that because of the often hostile environment in North America, the people of African descent, and I would also say the indigenous population as well, whose numbers are substantially smaller, have oftentimes had to reach across the borders to forge alliances with powers that have conflicts with the United States, not only Britain, say, in the antebellum period, but that extends into the 20th century with Paul Robeson in Moscow, with the black nationalists, for example, in the 1930s with Tokyo, with the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 1920, and Jack Johnson, the former heavyweight champion, engaging in acts of solidarity with them before having to turn himself in and be arrested.
There is the Bandung Conference.
Bandung Conference in Indonesia in the 1950s, a early precursor, if you like, of the non-aligned movement, predominantly countries of Asian extraction and African extraction meeting together to form a third force in the context of the Cold War. You had Paul Robeson, for example, whose passport had been taken by that point, extending a message of solidarity to the Bandung Conference. So this has been a long-term, long-time trend to try to level the playing field, to try to get more people on our side to fight these white supremacists in North America. But at the same time, of course, you can make an argument that it's also intensified our persecution and made the black population in particular be perceived as, quote, unpatriotic, unquote.
Before we dive into 1776, you write that there are important developments that happen in England.
Oh, yes.
The Glorious Revolution and the Somerset case.
Yes.
Let's talk about both of those. Let's begin with what was the Glorious Revolution.
Circa 1688, the powers of the monarchy in London are reduced as against the powers of the rising merchant class. Theretofore, the Royal African Company had been the leading force in the African slave trade, and it was under the thumb of the monarchy. With the reduction of the power of the monarchy and the rise in power of the merchant class, the African slave trade faces deregulation, if you like. It leads to what I refer to as free trade in Africans. That is to say that the trade is opened up to a host of freelance slave dealers who descend upon Africa with maniacal energy, like crazed bees, chaining and manacling every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic to work in the sugar fields of the Caribbean or the tobacco fields of the Chesapeake area of the North American mainland. But this creates problems, particularly in the Caribbean, where the Africans are outnumbering the Europeans, leading to these huge slave revolts.
And throughout the Caribbean.
Throughout the Caribbean. Yeah. Of course.
You have one of the depictions from a revolt in Jamaica
right.
On the cover of your book.
Absolutely. Yeah. And by the 1730s, for example, in Jamaica, there was fear in London that the entire colonial enterprise would collapse. Should not be surprising, given the fact that Britain only claimed Jamaica from the Spanish in 1655.
And this is a period where Africans were more concentrated in the Caribbean than they were in
exactly.
North America.
Exactly. Up until the middle of the 18th century, London felt that the Caribbean colonies were worth more than their colonies in North America. But what happens is that because of the rebelliousness of the Africans in the Caribbean, what occurs is what I call a great trek, which may resonate with those familiar with South African history, because it's very similar. That is to say, the Europeans begin this great trek from the Caribbean to the mainland. And one of their supposed solutions to African rebelliousness was to create a so-called all-white colony in the state of Georgia. What's interesting is that Georgia, according to the 2010 census, has the largest population of African descent in these United States of America, which is ironic since it started off as a so-called all-white colony, trying to escape the uproariousness of rebelliousness of rebellious Africans. But it didn't work because, among other reasons, it was hard to get many Europeans to work in the fields. And then, of course, they're more expensive. It's more difficult to enslave them. It introduces class contradictions between and amongst Europeans that these European elites were trying to escape when they fled Europe. So they had to bring in more Africans there. This is taking place in the context of a contest in the hemisphere between the so-called Catholic powers, France and Spain, on the one hand, and the Protestant power, Britain, on the other. Spain, in particular, as early as the 1500s, had begun to arm Africans. This puts competitive pressure on Britain to do the same, particularly after the Spanish give the British a real shellacking in the city that we now know as Cartagena, Colombia. So Britain feels that it's losing ground to Spain because it is not able to put as many arms in the arms of Africans. And so it begins to do the same, but that creates problems with the settlers, because that's contrary to their model of development, which is not arming Africans, but enchaining Africans. It gets to the point where in June 1772, with Somerset's case, London moves to abolish slavery in London itself.
But not altogether.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's feared that that decision would be exported to the mainland. And in my telling of the story, this is a trigger for revolt against London in 1776, leading to the formation of the United States of America. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that in order to understand the formation of the United States, you have to understand, A, the so-called Black Scare. That is to say, this fear that London would bring armed Africans to the North American mainland to impose discipline upon European settlers, which was quite frightening and certainly contrary to their model of development, which is slavery.
White people here were fearful of that.
Absolutely they were, particularly after Lord Dunmore, the last colonial governor of Virginia, who in 1775 moves explicitly in that direction. I mean, you have to understand, it takes quite a bit to get people to rebel against their motherland, against their homeland. I mean, these were British subjects, these settlers. And a trigger for this trailblazing rebellion against London was the Black Scare. And I think that that helps to inform and infuse the subsequent history of the United States of America and, as noted, sheds light upon the terrible life conditions that so many people of African descent face as we speak in North America in 2014.
Tell me more about Lord Dunmore. And I guess he had two regiments, one white, one black.
Well, you have to realize that Britain is a relatively small country. Even today, it only has a population of 55 to 60 million. And it has this relatively small population. And at the same time, it's trying to subdue India. It's trying to subdue North America. It's trying to subdue the Caribbean. At the same time, London had reason to believe that all of its subjects were not necessarily politically reliable. In a few months, we'll face a vote on Scottish secession. Scotland only comes into the United Kingdom in 1707. There are major revolts throughout the 18th century, including in the 1740s. We all know the story of Ireland and the colonizing of Ireland and the fact that the Irish are oftentimes seen as not being politically reliable as well. This puts enormous pressure on London in the face of its colonial conquest to find more people to arm, particularly given the competitive pressure from the Catholic powers, Spain in the first place. So this leads directly to the edict of the last colonial governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, to arm Africans and unleash them against rebellious colonists and settlers led by people like Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson and all the rest.
So this did happen. Armed Africans were sent in by the British to try to control the white settlers here.
As I tell the story, in early 1776, there was a real possibility that the rebellion could have been squashed in its cradle. But what happens is that many of the armed Africans take sick and die.
And from this, disease.
Exactly. And this gives impetus to July 4th, 1776. I should also say that there's a dog that didn't bark that needs to be discussed. What I mean is that by 1763, the British had ousted the Spanish from Florida. The Spanish Florida had bedeviled South Carolina, North Carolina in particular, sending armed Africans across the border from St. Augustine. What happens is that the British decide to fight the so-called Seven Years' War, 1756 to 1763, to oust the Spanish from Florida and to oust the French from Quebec. By the time of 1776, Florida is a British colony, but it doesn't rebel. Why? I make the supposition that because of the disproportionate number of Africans in Florida and the disproportionate number of armed Africans in Florida as a legacy of Spanish Florida and as a result of British personnel policies then unfolding, some of the Africans who perished in Virginia, who had gone in early 1776 to try to squash the incipient revolt, actually had hailed from Florida. So what I'm suggesting is that the formation of the United States was based on a number of contingencies. It was not, A, inevitable that this country would emerge. And certainly, as I tell the story, I think it is profoundly mistaken to see the formation of the United States of America as some great leap forward for humanity. Certainly, it's true that the United States rescued countless Europeans and provided various liberties and emoluments to them. But that's not how. That's not what we're told. I mean, somehow people begin to garble their language when it gets to the discussion of what happens to the enslaved population after 1776.
We are in conversation with Gerald Horn. Gerald Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morse Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of the new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States. So this is what you are calling the counter-revolution of 1776, which we actually call the revolution of 1776. You call it a counter-revolution because of the fear of what with the Somerset case in London, that there was a fear that slavery was coming to an end. Hence, you're saying that the real war was about keeping slavery intact.
A couple points. One, I call it a counter-revolution because in many ways the revolt against British rule was motivated by a revolt against the abolition of slavery as foreshadowed by Somerset's case, it was thought, in June 1772. It's also striking to note that the experiment of the United States of America crashes and burns in 1861 to 1865 precisely because of slavery. The fortunately deceased Confederate States of America and its leaders argued quite passionately that they were walking in the footsteps of 1776 because obviously the founding fathers, as they are now called, had no particular objection to slavery. So the Confederate States of America said, well, then slavery should be allowed to continue, not only allowed to continue, but to expand into the new territories taken from the indigenous population. Fortunately, they were defeated in a bloody civil war. But I argue that this bloody civil war, more than the result of what has been called a tragic flaw, i.e. slavery, it was a result of a design flaw. That is to say, this was designed as a slaveholders' republic, but it was very difficult to maintain a slaveholders' republic, particularly in the 19th century, after the formation of the Republic of Haiti, which began to engage in fearsome militant acts of solidarity with the enslaved African population of the North American mainland, and particularly after London, the leading power, moves towards abolition, not least because after they lost the United States, they lost one of their major markets for Africans, that is to say, of the African slave trade. And that provided impetus for London to move towards abolition and then engage in acts of solidarity with the Haitians and with the enslaved Africans in North America in order to perhaps even reclaim North American territory lost to the rebels in 1776. You should also know that slavery was not a sideshow in terms of the origins of the United States of America. Some of the profits on the slave trade were eye-watering and eye-popping, up to 1,700%. And as you know, there are certain investors, even today, who might even sell their firstborn for a profit of 1,700%. Not only that, but then the slave owners and the slave traders would take the profits from that human flesh peddling and pour it into allied industries such as shipping, insurance, banking, I make the further argument in this book that in terms of understanding the takeoff of the system known as capitalism, you have to understand the African slave trade, because this system takes off and enters onto the world stage in a huge way with the blood of Africans dripping from every pore. And therefore, it's difficult to understand the trajectory and history of capitalism itself, the system under which we now live in North America, without understanding the slave trade.
It's not just that slavery helped propel capitalism because you had free labor. The slave trade itself was big business.
The slave trade itself was big business. The profits were poured into capitalist enterprise. The slave trade itself was, in many ways, a capitalist enterprise. I also make a commentary on what I call militarized identity politics. It's very interesting in the United States of America, as you well know, being at Pacifica, this term identity politics is tossed around derisively and dismissively and attached to various movements, but it's rarely attached to its origins, because the formation of the United States of America is based on a militarized form of identity politics known as whiteness. That is to say, how was it that people who were English and British and Scottish, when they crossed the Atlantic, they're transmuted into, quote, white, unquote. Yeah. And what I suggest, and I'm here following in the footsteps of other scholars, I should say, with all fairness, that whiteness in many ways was a much more successful project than ethnicity, that is, or even religion, which was another motivating factor for colonial expansion. I mean, for example, the Spanish obviously had a problem when, to an extent, their leaders insisted that their colonizers also be Spanish, whereas with whiteness, you could draw from the entire European continent, from the Atlantic to the Urals, and incorporate them into this expansive concept that is whiteness, or white American, as it's called today. And it was quite successful, quote unquote, in the sense that it provided a larger population base by which one could more successfully combat restive Native Americans, rebellious Africans. And I think that from this point forward, those who use this term identity politics should also make reference to the original militarized identity politics, which was whiteness.
Yeah. You have done a lot of your own scholarship and research to write this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. You spent a good amount of time at the New York Historical Society. When we are taught the Revolution of 1776, we commonly are given these quotes, again, about the Enlightened principles. Were you able to find documentation that showed that this war was actually to keep slavery intact?
Oh, sure. The documents are all over the place, which obviously makes a commentary about previous scholars. But since they'll be reviewing my work, I won't go any further. But I mean, the documents, they're profuse. I mean, I did research, as you note, at the New York Historical Society, but also in California at the Huntington Library in Southern California. It has a treasure trove of documentation about the slave trade in particular, and particularly about this debate in the late 17th century about the deregulation of the African slave trade leading to free trade in Africans, the debate between the merchants and the Royal African Company. I will say that some of our previous scholars with regard to this period, haven't done as much work in London as they could have, because at the National Archives of the UK in London, not to mention the British Library, you have a profusion of documents that help to inform the story. But more than that, I think telling this story, it reminds me of the first Rodney King trial prosecution of the officers of the law who beat this black motorist 20-odd years ago, captured on videotape, and then they were put on trial. You may recall that during the trial, the first jury trial, the defense lawyers would take that tape and they'd break it down. Rather than show it in a continuous loop, they would show it frame by frame to the jury. And every frame, they would say, do you see any offense here? Did you see any offense there? And oftentimes, this rather credulous jury would say, no. And I think that's part of the problem with history, because oftentimes in 1776, the historians, they begin the story in the 1770s. I think that's too late. That's like looking at the United States between 1941 and 1945, when it's in alliance with Moscow, and therefore anti-communism is on the defensive, and saying, oh, you know, the United States is an anti-communist country because anti-communism is on the defensive in 1942-43. You have to begin the story decades earlier and then unwind the tape flowing, say, from the Glorious Revolution, at least up into 1776, rather than parachuting into 1770 and beginning the story there, which is what too often happens.
Do we have quotes, though, from quote-unquote founding fathers, revolutionaries, talking about the need for the war to keep slavery in place?
Oh, yeah. You know, I quote them at length in this book, particularly the 5'4" bookish James Madison, a graduate of Princeton University, a president of the United States at the time of the War of 1812, where the United States almost loses its sovereignty, not least because of a de facto alliance between enslaved Africans and London, which I talk about in my book, Negro Comrades of the Crown. Slavery was the hovering, lurking presence that haunted these founders, not least because, as detailed in my chapter, which, as I recall, is entitled something like Arsons, Murders, Poisonings, and Shipboard Insurrections. These were all acts of agency by enslaved Africans. The Africans were on the warpath, particularly after the deregulation of the African slave trade begins to assert itself, and Africans begin cascading across the Atlantic in huge numbers, creating enormous strains. And I think it's fair for the audience to infer that people don't like being enslaved. They don't like being forced to work for free, particularly taken thousands of miles from their homeland. And so they begin to rebel. And the United States has an enormous problem when they begin to ally first with the indigenous population, then with the Spanish, and then with the French, and so on.
George Washington would eventually have Africans in his regiment.
Well, that's what I mean about it being improper and inappropriate and misleading to begin the story in the 1770s, because, of course, I mean, he has a problem with personnel. He has a problem of, quote, manpower, unquote. And so
they recognize there's this problem going on during the Revolutionary War that Africans are fighting with the British.
Yes. And so in order to combat that, he makes a certain kind of concession. And I should say that that a number of Africans fought with the rebels, although, of course, the fact that their plight deteriorated after the formation of the United States perhaps speaks volumes about their decision. Likewise, we know that after the U.S. Civil War, there were these so-called Buffalo Soldiers regiments who were the tip of the spear in terms of the liquidation of independent Native American polities, which I judge to be one of the most flagrant and disastrous and destructive decisions ever engineered by people of African descent in North America, because at once it helped to weaken an ally, that is to say Native American populations, and at the same time gave impetus to our primary foes headquartered in Washington. But at the same time, your audience, I'm sure, already knows, and certainly those who don't need to know about that particular development.
Yeah. Gerald Horn, what's the importance, do you think, of casting this story as the counter-revolution of 1776, the title of your book? What is the importance of casting this as a counter-revolution for our political discourse today?
Political discourse today, I would hope that it would induce a bit of humility on the part of patriotic citizens of the United States of America. As you know, the United States is replete with critics of virtually every revolution since 1776, you know, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, the Iranian Revolution, etc. Yet, with regard to their own so-called revolution, it's hard to find a critic, even on the left. I mean, you would think it was all upside. Even though you have all these people of African descent walking through the streets of North America, and you would wonder, well, you know, they were enslaved. Did they join with their slave owners to to fight, or did they join with the opponents of their slave owners? So I would hope that this introduces a certain kind of humility on the part of people of the United States, that it would help make them more measured and reasoned in evaluating other revolutionary processes, not least the Cuban Revolution and the Iranian Revolution. And I would hope it would also shed light on why it is that there is a persistent conservatism in the United States of America, not least amongst those who were designated as the prime beneficiaries of the, quote, revolution, unquote. I'm speaking of those who were defined as, quote, white, unquote. And oftentimes you see the left, they sort of glide over that fact. I conclude this book by talking about the election in Louisiana for governor in 1991, where an avowed Nazi and Klansman, David Duke, got a healthy majority, or perhaps an unhealthy majority, of the so-called white population's vote. Now, this is staggering that you know, people are voting for fascism. But I don't think that you can begin to understand that decision unless you understand the grimy origins of the United States of America and how it's been glorified.
They didn't see themselves voting for fascism.
Well, I think some did. I mean, some were just voting against the Black Scare.
I mean, I guess what I was trying to get at is they were buying into this narrative of the founding of the country.
Well, to me, in many ways, what was driving the bulk of those voters was the Black Scare, once again, which drove many of their ancestors in 1776. And I would also hope that we would look across the borders. I mean, for example, we have this control group, Canada, that didn't rebel against British rule. But Canada has the single-payer healthcare system that friends on the left tell us that we should aspire towards. Canada has a social democratic party, the New Democratic Party, the NDP, which despite weaknesses has ruled provinces. We have nothing of the kind across the border in the United States of America, although this is the country that supposedly had the Grand Revolution. Australia, which I talk about in my previous book, The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas after the Civil War. Australia's history is very similar to that in the United States. But in Australia, there's much more self-criticism of the founding of that country by European settlers, much more criticism about the dispossession of the indigenous. I mean, here we are in the state of California. There's a book called Murder State about the so-called settling of California, and the title says it all. There's hardly any discourse, even on the left, about the original inhabitants of the state of California, what happened to them, how they were subjected to ethnic cleansing, how they were massacred, subjected to genocide, et cetera, even within progressive forces. So I'm hoping that this book will be one step forward, along with others, to try to recreate a more accurate history of this North American mainland that takes into account not only the sufferings of the dispossessed, but also the rebelliousness of the dispossessed.
History is political, and it shapes our political discourse today, I would argue. Do you think with the changing demographics of this country, in particular states, yours, Texas, here in California, do you think the narrative, the historic narrative of the founding of this country changes with time? Or is this what you will call a creation myth, something that is going to continue to dominate the story?
I believe the former. That is to say that my book is a direct result of struggle. That is to say that students struggled for Black studies in the 1960s and 1970s, helping to open up opportunities for professors like myself, for those of you who can't see me. I'm melanin rich, as they say. And I entered the academy determined to tell a different story, which leads to this book. And there are others like me throughout the academy. I should also add this fact that a few days ago, the World Bank adjudged that for the first time since 1872, the United States is not the leading economy of the world. It's China. And I think that as that fact begins to assert itself more powerfully, it'll lead to self-doubt on the part of many U.S. nationals, agonizing reappraisals, leading once again to a determination to reconstruct the history so we can better understand the present.
History is all about today, and there's a battle for what is the dominant narrative, and a battle against from forgetting.
Oh, absolutely. It's just like why in the state of Texas, which you mentioned, the right wing is organized to influence textbooks that are used in K through 12. And in my estimation, the estimation of many others, trying to tell a flawed story, a story that uplifts conservatism and downgrades anything that is not conservative. From their
and that's
point,
the stories of the revolution of 1776.
Exactly. From their point of view, this is important to put a gust of wind in the sails of today's conservatism. And so likewise, those of us who are not conservatives, we're trying to tell what we consider to be a truer story, which we hope will put gust of wind in the sails of progressive and even radical forces.
Gerald Horn, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Again, Gerald Horn has been our guest. We've been in conversation about his new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America.